If we could just move the pews outside, right? Sit out in the sunshine, the cool day today, it'd be wonderful. It's good to be here today. It's good to see each of you. Thank you for coming. We're going to begin with a prayer, and I'm going to ask Brother Wayne Hatcher to come and lead our prayer, and then we'll get started. May I have to have somebody hold the microphone while I preach this morning, and I'll preach as long as he can hold the hand up. How about that?
If I'd have known you standing in front of me, I probably couldn't have said a word.
Yeah. I didn't know you were saying. Well, that proves you close your eyes when you pray, doesn't it? All right. If you're visiting with us tonight, and we do have guests, we thank you for being here. We're studying some spiritual heart disease. Last week, well, that's my sermon for this morning, which we don't want to get into today. Right now, I'm confused enough as it is. I only do the PowerPoint for your benefit anyway. I'd just soon not even have it, but I kind of want to give y'all a feel of where we're going. I'll let them load it up. We were finishing up the disease of unforgiveness, and we mentioned several aspects of unforgiveness. We talked about how important it is. We talked about how Jesus forgives. Somebody give me a thumbs up back there when you get it going. We were finishing up how to develop this attitude of forgiveness when the bell rang. And we were talking about when the bell rang, how much we have been forgiven. If I can stop and just consider how much God has forgiven me, then certainly I am going to be more inclined to forgive another person, because nobody has ever and will ever offend me as much as I've offended my God. And so if I can look with thankfulness and gratefulness for what God's done for me, then surely I ought to forgive you of anything you've done for me. And then, of course, we were talking about asking for the assistance of God. We'll go through this. These are some things we talked about last week. We talked about why we ought to forgive, attitudes toward unforgiveness that people manifest, how to learn and cultivate forgiveness, all right? We need to ask for God's assistance. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And we need to make sure that we know the difference between saying a prayer and praying a prayer. Prayer should be the earnest desire of a man's heart expressed to God. And when we truly ask for God to help us in having the right attitude toward an individual that's done us wrong, that's going to go a long way toward overcoming that barrier that might be between individuals. You might recite a portion of the disciples' prayer, and thus you would say, God, forgive me, and you put your name in there. Forgive me as I forgive, and then add that person's name instead of just a generic term. Forgive me of my trespasses, Father, as I forgive John or Jack or Diane or Susie or whoever the case may be. And so that would be helpful as well. Also, we need to practice praying for our offender. Be specific. Call his name. Jesus was very specific. He prayed for his offenders, and he wanted them to be forgiven. He wanted them to come to a knowledge of the truth. And, you know, it's amazing to me how our Lord could pray all night. Have you ever thought about that? Praying all night. How could he do that? Well, I don't think our Lord prayed in general terms, did he? I think the Lord was very specific in what and who he prayed for. And we need to try to work at that as well. You know, have specific things in mind, make specific lists perhaps of those that we want to pray for. And we need to learn to pray for our offender. This is difficult as well, but speak to others in a kind way about the one that has offended you. somebody's done you an injustice, intentionally try to say good things about that person to somebody else. And then, of course, this is a key right here. I think it comes under the same category as practicing the golden rule. Try to develop an understanding heart. Usually, there is some kind of circumstance or cause why somebody acted in a discourteous way toward you. Something maybe is going on that you do not know about behind the curtain. Something's happened, perhaps. And so just don't be so quick and inclined to be offended if somebody, in your perception, acted in a discourteous way towards you. Somebody may be a victim of their heredity or environment. Maybe they have had something misrepresented to them in some particular way. We all have different personalities, right? You know, how many different automobiles do we have out here today in the parking lot? You know, we've got Chevys and Fords and Buicks and Hyundais and Toyotas and all kinds of, we could just go on and name different kinds and then different models and so forth. Well, we have different personalities, don't we? You know, we're all weird in our own way, aren't we? We're all weirdos. You know, none of us are normal, we might say. We've all got our own quirks. And so try to develop an understanding heart and try to see things from the other person's perspective. That is so very important. And then we need to cultivate the grace of mercy and compassion. Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful." Why? For they shall obtain mercy. You know, if I want God's mercy extended to me, I must be merciful toward other people. Now, we're talking about something that is not easy to do. This is something that's very difficult to acquire. As we've said last week and spent quite a bit of time on, it's easy to, you know, return evil for evil and to return in kind what somebody does to us. And if we're not careful, we can fall into that trap. And so we need to cultivate an attitude of compassion toward other people. Quickly, and we're spending too much time on this, let's talk about how I am to forgive. There it goes. How am I to forgive? Well, let me suggest, first of all, we need to forgive from the heart. You know, we need to avoid lip service. You've wronged me and you come to me, well, I forgive you. And then you leave gritting your teeth. I'm going to get him back just as sure as I'm standing here, you know. We may give lip service that we have forgiven, but in reality, maybe we haven't. We don't need to continue to harbor malice and ill will in our heart. We need to forgive from the heart. And then we need to forgive as God forgives. We are the offspring of God. We're made in God's image. We need to walk as God would have us to walk. And so how does God forgive? Well, first of all, God forgives freely. There's no constraint. God freely forgives us. God forgives us abundantly. There's no piecemeal forgiveness with God. He forgives us abundantly. And he forgives us immediately. There's no period of probation. There's no time payments. And then God forgives us finally. He doesn't bring it up again. We emphasized that last week, how God forgives us. He remembers it no more. He treats us as if we had never even committed that particular sin. And then he forgives us uncalculatingly. That is, he forgives us again and again. Which brings us to another point briefly. How often must we forgive? Now, you recall that Peter in Matthew chapter 18 came to the Lord. Lord, how often shall we forgive? Until what? Seven times. You know, Peter thought he was doing well, didn't he? Peter doubled what the rabbis said, you know, forgive up to three times, and then he added one. And he thought, man, that's just really great. If I can forgive somebody seven times. But notice what the Lord said in Matthew 18, 21 and 22. He said, I say unto you, until seven times, but until 70 times seven. Now, some folks want to take that literally, right? Is it all right to take the Bible literally? Yeah, I think it is. But some people won't take that literally. And they got their little list, right? They're waiting for it to get 490 times. And when it gets to that point, you're done, you know. They'll even do what the Lord said here. But you know, what the Lord is saying here is there's no limit to the forgiveness we are to extend towards somebody else. Forgiveness is qualitative, the Lord says. It's not quantitative. He's teaching us not to keep a ledger. Because forgiveness is not a matter of arithmetic. It's not a matter of bookkeeping, but it's a matter of love. Love has no limits. And so we are to forgive as much as an offender is willing to ask for forgiveness. And so we need to avoid saying it won't do any good to forgive him. He'll just do it again. You know, don't even worry about it. He's done it once, he's done it twice or more, and he'll just continue to do so. But as long as the individual will turn and say, I repent, we are to forgive him. Now, getting to some more practical stuff as we close this lesson out, let's talk about who takes the initiative in forgiveness. And I think this is very, very important for us to understand. If you turn over to the book of Matthew, chapter 5, and I want us to look at Matthew chapter 5, around verse 23, if you'll turn there with me there. Of course, we're familiar with the Beatitudes, and out in verse 23, Jesus said, so if you're offering your gift at the altar, all right, you come and you worship God, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift before the altar. Go and first be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. I think there's a very, very strong implication for us as children of God here in regard to our worship. If we're going to worship scripturally, then we need to, first of all, try to work out things with the offended one. We need to try to straighten things out. And so many times, the shortest distance to God may be the distance to your brother's house. Now, I wonder if we all obeyed that command today in the church, churches throughout the land. How many auditoriums would lose a significant number of people in attendance today if we first went and were reconciled to our brother before we came and offered worship to God? And if the inspired instructions of this passage were followed, it might break up some worship services today. In other words, there's no use in trying to talk to God if we're not on speaking terms with our brother. And consider here the offended as well. You know, if I am the offender, there's a responsibility that I have. I am to go to that person. What about the offended? Oftentimes, you know, we have the attitude, well, he wronged me. You know, he sinned against me, so let him take the initiative. Go back to our relationship with God again. Who sinned against who in regard to our relationship with God? We sinned against him, did we not? Right? When we were without strength in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. While we were still in a state of rebellion, a state of sin against God, God took the initiative. And so the offended in our relationship with God took the initiative. And so if I have been offended, what does that tell me I need to do? I believe this is the least obeyed command in the Bible, right here. One of the least, one of the top three or four anyway. You know, how many people, if they're offended, will go to the one that has offended them? Well, that's exactly right, you know. Okay. George gave an example of somebody he knew of in the church one time that an individual had quit going to church, and an individual went as a concerned brother to them about, you know, coming back to church and, you know, asking, you know, if there's anything that we can do. Has anybody offended you? And he found out he was the one that offended the fella to start with, the one that went. He didn't even know it, see? So a lot of times, you know, we're not, an individual's not even aware that he has offended somebody else. We're human beings, aren't we? Sometimes we say and do things that don't just come across in the right way. We don't use much tact. And so we need to be careful about that. And so the Lord took the initiative, though, right? We had offended God. Sin separated us from God. God sent the initiative. Because of the great love which he showed toward us, he sent his Son to die on the cross for our sins. When we were without strength in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. And he sought and he saved the sinner. Now, let's suppose a case here. Here's Brother A and Brother B. Okay, Brother A sins against Brother B. When the Bible is really followed, both will take the initiative and we'll meet halfway, and reconciliation will follow. That generally is what's going to happen. In other words, generally, 99 out of 100, things should never fester. You should never have any problem. 99 times out of 100, things can be smoothed over. Things can even be better than they ever were. But what happens sometimes? We pooch our lips out, right? Get all offended, you know? It's almost like a bee sting, you know. Venom fills your body, and you're ready to kill somebody, maybe. And instead of taking care of it, Virginia? Yeah. I've had people come to me sometimes, and I hope what I said to you out in the foyer or something, I'm sorry about that. I said, what are you talking about? I didn't even take it that way, or, you know, but it's good that somebody is conscientious enough to want to take care of something that they thought may have offended somebody else. You know, all of us, you know, we're going to speak some things sometimes. We may go back and think, did that come across the way I wanted it to come across? Sometimes we don't know how to use tact, good, do we? And so we may think about something that we've done, and we go back and try to correct it, and it ends up being nothing. Wayne?
You know, so many times, we do more harm by not pulling people. Mm-hmm. And we do it because we don't pull them in enough. It's like someone here in the congregation slips and falls and does something it shouldn't be doing. If we sit back and let that go, we do it harm to them, we do it harm to the congregation.
Okay. All right. That's right. As the Barney Fife philosophy says, what? Nip it in the bud, right? Okay, nip it in the bud. Wayne says sometimes, you know, somebody slips up, messes up or whatever, instead of going to them and taking care of it, we let it fester. Usually, we hear the term, you know, it's the straw that broke the camel's back. That in and of itself wasn't a big deal, right? But that compounded with everything else we've let build up, you know. You know, a zit's going to pop, you know, when it gets full enough, I guess you might say. And I guess that's a good comparative illustration to how people let things fester up that really shouldn't mean much. You know what I mean? We ought to take care of it. we ought to go to somebody who has offended us and vice versa and take care of it. And like I say, 99% of all problems among brethren, I think, would be solved if we would just follow the Lord's simple instructions. Now, let's go on and add to this just a little bit. You're not going to have much to forgive another person if you will refuse to be thin-skinned. Now, think about one of the characteristics of love among many in 1 Corinthians 5. Love is not easily provoked. In other words, how many of you check your eggs when you go to the grocery store? Open it up and make sure there's no cracks in them. Anybody? We all do. At least we should, you know. You tell the guy, pack it, be careful of those eggs now. You know, thin skin. Sometimes we're like eggshell. We walk around like eggshell sometimes. We can be cracked or broken at the slightest little thing. We're always looking with a critical eye to interpret every word and every action in some critical kind of way. Little minds are wounded by little things. That's something to consider. And so we don't need to be the kind of people that are going around carrying a chip on our shoulder because that indicates, you know, wood that's higher up. In fact, the heaviest of all loads is to carry the chip on one's shoulder. And we need to realize that we just don't need to go around very easily offended. You know, all of us know of people, we've just got to watch what we say around them, right? They're just always going to take it in the wrong way. So we don't need to be like that. That'll stop a lot of it right there. Also, if we can get lost in another great cause, then we're not going to be easily offended. You know, as long as self is the center, that's where all of our problems come from, right? I can look at all the problems that I've had in my life. You know where it comes from? Selfishness. I guarantee you almost all of my problems in life come from an attitude of selfishness, being focused on self. As long as self is the center, a person can be easily offended and hurt. But if I can get lost in something that's greater than me, if I can get lost in the greatest cause on this earth, the church, I'm not going to have time for petty offenses, am I? I'm not going to have time for little things. Imagine slights and insults. And so this is something that we need to seriously consider. All right, we've got to move on. If anybody's not got any comments, we spent more time on that longer than I wanted to. I'd like to move on to the next PowerPoint if we can get it loaded up. This next spiritual disease, heart disease, that I want us to consider is something that we would call envy. Now, an individual might be a faithful churchgoer. An individual might attend every service, might be a morally upright individual, upstanding in that way, and yet harbor enough envy in his heart to cause his soul to be condemned. I believe that, I think we've got it up here now. There we go. All right. I thought that was the PowerPoint making that noise for a minute. Thought I downloaded some action I didn't know about there. All right. Envy. Envy is a common sin. I don't think there's any person that has not had some kind of difficulty at some point with envy. It's a green-eyed monster that has had an impact on all of us at some point or another. And yet, how many of us have heard somebody confess the sin of envy? I don't know if I've ever heard anybody. You've heard somebody confess the sin of envy? Done it yourself? Good, that's great. It's hard to recognize, but it's something we need to recognize. Envy has been pictured as a devilish thing with wide ears for the catching of slander, a tongue that's a serpent with feet standing in fire as a symbol of wretchedness. Socrates had a good definition of envy. Listen to this. Socrates said about envy that it's the daughter of pride. It is the author of murder and revenge. It is the begetter of secret sedition, the perpetual tormentor of virtue. Envy is the filthy slime of the soul, a venom, a poison, which consumes the flesh and dries up the marrow of the bones. Pretty good little prognosis of what envy is all about. And so let's define envy if we can here. Webster, in his dictionary, says envy is chagrin. It is discontent at the excellence or the good fortune of another. It's being resentful. It's being grudgy. Cruden's Concordance says of envy, discontent at the excellence or good fortune of another. And, of course, frequently in the Bible, with the distinct idea of malice or spite. Oftentimes, some of the new revisions, translations, use the word jealousy there in the place of envy. If you look at the etymology of the word, it means to look against. It means to eye with evil intent. You've ever heard about, you know, getting the evil eye? Maybe envy is a part of that. Envy is that uncomfortable, I like this, it's that uncomfortable feeling that one experiences over the advances, the advantages, and the good fortunes of another. Think about that. An envious person feels that any honor done for another is a galling dishonor to himself. Now, you read those things and you say, well, I could never be guilty of that. But let me ask you, have you ever felt uncomfortable when one experiences an advantage or a good fortune or some kind of advance? Has that kind of made you feel uncomfortable? You know, something good happens to somebody else and you just really have this eel type feeling in your stomach, George?
One of my favorite quotes is
comparison is the thief of joy. Teddy Roosevelt. Comparison is the thief of joy. You know, the Bible warns us about comparing ourselves with others, right? So we need to be aware of that. Don't compare yourself with others, and that includes this as well. That's right. And not only are we going to talk about Cain and Abel in just a few minutes, we're going to look at some other examples where envy was a contributor to sin, even the sin of murder, as is in the case of Cain and Abel. Because of envy, you remember how Rachel envied Leah because Rachel was barren and Leah was the mother of several children. He had possessions of flocks and herds and many more servants. We read about how the Philistines envied Isaac in Genesis chapter 26 in verse 14. Are you enjoying really living in your modest home? Maybe your 2 or 3 bedroom home until maybe a friend of yours gets a nicer home or in a nicer neighborhood. Are you enjoying driving your old Oldsmobile? Till somebody else, you know, around you gets a brand new Plymouth and so forth. And if you do, that's an indication of envy. You know, you look at the good fortunes of another person and you say, they don't deserve that. That's something that I need. That's something that ought to be happening to me. And so we have that evil eye, if you please. We resent the good fortune of another individual. You know, sometimes we look out as Christians, if we're not careful, and we can envy the wicked that are well-to-do in this world, can't we? You know, here we are, we're trying to serve God, aren't we? We're trying to live faithfully. And this person out here, look how they're blessed. Look at the material things that they're enjoying. They have no regard for God. They have no regard for spiritual things. And look how they prosper. Now, David kind of got caught up in this mentality until he went into the temple of God, right? He recognized they were on a slippery slope. You know, they're walking in slippery places right now. Sure, things may be good for them right now, but God doesn't, you know, send out the paychecks, right? In this lifetime. Ultimately, there's a payday coming in eternity. And so we don't need to get caught up with the here and the now. And just because somebody prospers here, they're not even a Christian, or maybe they're even an atheist, and they prosper physically. They prosper materially. You know, why is this happening to me? And so we have an envious eye. Let's talk about the nature of envy, if we can, for just a minute. We looked at envy illustrated. Let's talk about the nature of envy for just a moment. James chapter 3, verses 14 and 15 tells us that envy is earthly, it's sensual, it's devilish. Also, envy is insidious. In fact, it's so insidious that the righteous can be envious against the evil and against evil doers. Envy is so insidious that it can actually be the motive of doing good things, provided this particular good thing could conceivably result in something bad happening in the life of one I envy. Think about that. It could get so that I could actually want to do good if I know that ultimately that good might result in something bad happening to the person that I'm envying. Of course, we can look at an example of Philippians chapter 1. Also, it's not confined to any segment of society. Did y'all hear a bell? Did y'all hear something? I thought I might be having that ringing in my ear again. What? Oh, never mind. Okay. All right. I just thought I heard something. I looked at my clock and I said, all right. I thought, surely my phone's not off. All right. Let's go on. Envy is not confined to any segment of society. It grows in all soils. It grows in all climates. It can be said of sinners outside the church, and it can be said of brethren in the church. We know that Ephraim envied Judah, Isaiah 11 and verse 13. And so envy is not just a sin out in the world, right? It's just as much of a sin among God's people. And then we need to really keep this in mind, that envy will render its victims, and I like that term victim there, you're a victim if you envy. It renders its victims miserable and unhappy. Remember the definition that we gave just a minute ago of envy, talking about how we experience discomfort at the advantages and the good fortunes of other people. Remember the parable of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15? How the elder brother was envious? Was the elder brother a happy person? Does he look to be a joyous individual? No, he was a miserable, wretched individual. He was not at all. He envied his brother when he came back home. He envied the happiness his father expressed toward the coming home of his brother. Somebody said, the vulture who explores our innermost liver and drags out our heart and nerves is not the kind of bird of whom our poets talk, but those diseases of the soul, envy and wantonness. And so envy will render us miserable and unhappy. Think about cancer. None of us like to think about that dreaded word, but envy is described as the cancer of the bone. Over in Proverbs 14, verse 30, envy is the rottenness of the bones. Just like malignancy is to the bones, or leprosy is to the flesh, so is envy to our spiritual beings. It'll lead us away. It will destroy us spiritually. And then notice in Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 4 that envy is classified as being worse than wrath or anger. So that says a lot about envy, the nature of envy and what it is. It's a terrible, insidious thing. Now, let's look at the associates of envy, if we can, for just a minute. Look at all the things in the Bible that is directly associated with envy. And I'm not going to, there's some of the verses there. I didn't put the specifics down. I just put the verses up there for you to consider. 1 Peter 2 and verse 1, it's associated with malice and guile, hypocrisies, and evil speakings. And you can see the connection between those two. In Galatians 5, 19 through 21, envy is associated with adultery, sexual immorality, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, drunkenness, murders, revelings, and such like. In 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 20, it's associated with wrath and strife, backbitings, whisperings. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 4, strife, railings, evil surmisings, perverse disputings. Titus 3 and verse 3, envy is associated with foolishness, disobedience, deception, various lusts and pleasures, malice and hate. 1 Corinthians 3, 1 through 3, again, it's associated with strife and divisions. See the connection here between envy and all these sins. In Romans chapter 1, verses 29 through 32, envy is associated with unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whispering, backbiting, hating God, despitefulness, proudness, boasting, invention of evil things, disobedience to parents, ignorance, covenant breaking without natural affection, and unmercifulness. So there you see, it's a terrible, terrible thing. And so from a study of these various vices and sins from which envy is associated, maybe we can begin to get a glimpse of God's estimation of the blackness of envy. We can begin to see how God detests envy. And though many wouldn't dream about being guilty of all these things we talked about, these various lists here in these verses, we need to realize that if we're guilty of envy, we're guilty of something just as horrible in God's sight. It's just as despicable, it's just as destructive and disgraceful, and it will condemn our souls just as well as any other of these things that are mentioned. All right, as time's getting away here, let's look at some of the havoc, the results that envy can lead to. Think about, for example, because of envy, it's already been mentioned, Cain slew Abel. Because of envy, he did that. Can you imagine flesh and blood, one brother killing another brother because of envy? You know, God warned Cain, didn't he? If you do well, but if you not, sin lies at the door. So, you know, Cain let this fester. And when he found the opportunity, he killed his own brother. Because of envy, the Philistines stopped Isaac's well in Genesis chapter 26. Think about Joseph and his brothers. We're familiar with that story. The Bible talks about the home life of Joseph, how his brothers envied him. They couldn't even speak a peaceable word to him at home. I can't imagine what his home life might have been like, where his own brothers hated him and despised him and were envious of him. And finally, they thought they killed their brother when they sold him as a slave into Egypt. Because of envy, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram rebelled against Moses and his authority in the wilderness. And sometimes envy causes problems in the church today, right? It causes us to not respect the authority that God has even set up in the church. And envy will lead to even division and disunity among God's people. Because of envy, Saul literally tried to hunt down David like he would hunt down a wild animal. seeking his life. Remember how the people sang, Saul has slain his thousands. David has slain his 10,000s. Saul couldn't stand that. It just ate him up like cancer, and it destroyed him. Because of envy, Jesus Christ was crucified. You think about that. Envy led our own Lord to the cross. The religious leaders of that day couldn't stand the fact that Jesus was now assuming a prominent position in the hearts of the people. Because of envy, the apostles were cast into prison and were otherwise persecuted. And because of envy, the Gentile world would ultimately and utterly become degenerate and apostate. And so, just look at the havoc that envy has caused in the earth. Now let's look next at envy at work in our world today. Bell's just about to ring. Members of the church today, getting more practical now, can be envious of one another. The one talent man was jealous of the five talent man. A brother in the church can be jealous of another who maybe is receiving recognition or praise for a job well done. Maybe one individual in the church envies another because of an appointment he received, or maybe a particular responsibility he's been given, or maybe some role that he's been asked to fill. An envious-hearted man may be tempted to bring up some old, unrepented of, forgiven sin in the life of the one that we envy. You know, here's something that's been taken care of a long time ago. You know, maybe here's an elder in the Lord's church that used to be a drunk in his previous life, but he obeyed the gospel, straightened his life out, and has become the finest Christian individual that ever lived, and living faithfully, and has now qualified himself to be an elder, and the people have accepted his leadership, and yet some brother's envious and brings up that past that is where it belongs. It's in the past. It's done. And he may be tempted to bring that up. Or maybe we're tempted to unsheathe the sword of our tongue and stab the envied brother with some malicious statement, or maybe some jealous prediction about the future or so forth. And so it can happen. Preachers can become envious of one another. One preacher can envy another preacher, maybe because he's having great success where he works and we're not having as much success here. Or maybe an envious preacher might be tempted to defame the character of another because he envies the success that this particular preacher may be having, rather than rejoicing at the success that may be going on at some other place. It's possible that congregations can envy one another. And we need to be careful that we don't envy another church just because maybe they've got more in attendance, or they've got better contributions, or a better building, and so forth. And next week, we're going to finish this up. We're kind of in the same boat we were last week. Next week, God's strict prohibitions against envy. We're going to touch on that, finish this up very quickly, and then we've got a good one coming up after that, another disease of the heart. There's some medications for these diseases, and we're going to talk about these medications as we get further into it. Thank you for your attention today. I appreciate it.